after the Robertson panel, within a year of that, the guys at Blue Book started getting these memos, really, from the bosses up in the Air Force to bring the unknowns down to 5%. And then throughout the late 50s, I mean, they were getting it down to like 1 and 2%. In order to this mean their investigative techniques had improved? Well, no, absolutely not. If anything, they got worse. But what they did do was, of course, force fit all kinds of possible explanations. Anything that could remotely be considered, you know, if you didn't investigate, hey, a lot of things are possible. And since they didn't do any investigations, everything became Venus or weather balloon or possible balloon or... And if it was a possible, then in the subsequent editions of the reports, the possible would be eliminated and it would just be, you know, a little...
There, my friends, this is Tim Benall of BenallofAmerica.com with another edition of Benall of America Audio. It is April 29th, 2006. Chances are you're hearing this after May 1st because we have crashed the BenallofAmerica.com website. We have completely blown it out of bandwidth for the month, an unexpected but somewhat expected occurrence. The growth of the site has been just tremendous. And every month it seems we get closer and closer to the limit, and this month we finally smashed the barrier of bandwidth, and the good folks who host BenallofAmerica.com put the hammer down on the site, shut us down for the weekend. We'll be back on May 1st. Chances are you're listening to us then. This problem will be corrected. Don't worry about that. It was more of a pleasant surprise, I suppose, because it is a sign of sure growth for the website. This week, we have for you an amazing interview, Richard Dolan, part one of two. We sat down for a lengthy conversation about a ton of topics. For those of you who don't know, Richard Dolan is the author of the amazingly well-researched UFOs and the National Security State. Most people who follow ufology are familiar with this book. If you haven't heard of the book or if you haven't read it, you've got to read it. It is amazing. It is a veritable history of ufology. It's the kind of book I wish I had discovered like 2 years ago. It filled in tons of gaps, tons of details. And I had the opportunity to read the book, I'd say like 2-3 weeks before we did the interview with Richard Dolan. I was reading the book over the course of a couple weeks. And then we had the interview. So all this stuff was fresh in my mind. I brought a bunch of questions I wanted answers to that were sort of to some of the more obscure points in the book and sort of overarching big picture type analysis. I think you guys are going to really dig that. And of course, the usual focus on the field of study itself and the UFO groups and some of the major names in ufology from back in the day and, you know, stuff I hadn't heard before and wanted to find out more about. And that's all in this week's edition. But for those of you unfamiliar with Richard Dolan, here's a little bit of background on him. Richard Dolan was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1962. He holds an MA in history from the University of Rochester and a BA in history from Alfred University. He earned a certificate of political theory from Oxford University and was a Rhodes Scholar finalist. Prior to his interest in anomalous phenomena, Dolan studied U.S. Cold War strategy, Soviet history, and international diplomacy. In 2000, he published a 500-page study, UFOs and the National Security State. This is the first volume of a two-part historical narrative on the national security dimensions of the UFO phenomenon from 1941 to the present. Included are the records of more than 50 military bases relating to innumerable violations of sensitive airspace by unknown objects, demonstrating that the U.S. military has taken the topic of UFOs seriously. Dolan has published numerous articles on anomalous phenomena, science, and the intelligence community for UFO Magazine. In 2003, he helped found Phenomena, a magazine dedicated to leading-edge issues pertaining to science and society, and for which he continues to serve as senior editor and regular contributor. Dolan has appeared many times on television documentaries and radio programs on the theme of UFOs and government disclosure. He has been a featured speaker at numerous conferences, including the International UFO Congress, the International MUFON Symposium, the Aztec UFO Symposium, and others. His website is www.keyholepublishing.com, K-E-Y-H-O-L-E, publishing.com. So as you can see, he's held in high regard in the UFO field. I'd call him almost a ufology historian, and it was really awesome to get a chance to speak with him for such a lengthy interview. Without any further ado, let's rock and roll, folks. This interview was recorded on April 3rd, 2006. Richard Dolan, part one of two on Banal of America Audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Banal of America Audio. I'm really excited to have as my guest this week Richard Dolan. He's the author of the hugely acclaimed UFOs and the National Security State, Chronology of a Cover-Up, 1941 to 1973. He studied political theory at Oxford University. He was a Rhodes Scholar finalist. He published the book in the year 2000, and it has gotten huge praise in ufology. Everybody says it's just an awesome book. I had the chance to read it as winter turns to spring this year. I read the book, and I was just completely blown away by it. I should have read it when I first got into ufology. I wish I knew now what I knew then, pretty much, now that I've read the book. And it was just awesome. And I'm hearing rumors that Volume 2 will be coming sometime later this year, maybe early next year. I don't know. We'll find out in the interview. But welcome to Banal of America Audio, Richard Dolan.
Thank you, Tim. Really nice to be on your show. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Let's start out a little bit with your background, your bio. How did you end up coming into the field of ufology?
Yeah, I, about 12 years ago, in 1994, I was just a regular old graduate student in Cold War Studies and History at the University of Rochester. Did your basic kind of standard Harry Truman, both of the CIA, the Defense Department, you know, all of that, the basic stuff. How did Americans deal with the Russians and so on?
Yeah.
And nothing with UFOs, nothing with flying saucers. And in the early 90s, I got the bug somehow. Got this question in my head, which was, did the U.S. military actually ever take this thing seriously? Because if they did, even if it was a mistake, I thought it would at least be noteworthy for the history of the Cold War. I mean, you think about it. If a four-star American general thought for a little while that some of these bizarre things might be aliens from another world in 1947, 1948, hey, that would certainly be of interest to any kind of academic study. And yet, of course, there's nothing. You go through formal academic libraries. I mean, there's no reference to UFOs in any way. So as a little project for myself, I thought, well, let me look into this and just see if there was anything to this. Really, very conservatively, very almost naively, going into this from that point of view. And of course, as I'm sure you realize quickly, there is an enormous amount of information here and a great deal of confirmed military documents, government documents that did indeed show what appeared to be strong levels of interest by senior personnel in this topic, very responsible CIA, military people, and so on. And so I thought, that's interesting. And then you'd want to know, well, why were they interested? And it turns out, well, they were interested for some very good reasons. There were, for example, many, many cases of apparent violations of sensitive airspace by objects that certainly did not look like conventional aircraft. They often looked like disc-shaped objects, for instance, objects that would move in very unusual ways, zigzag or stop on a dime or take off like a bullet and so forth. And then there would be cases where pilots would attempt to intercept these things. These objects were sometimes tracked on radar as well as seen visually. So there was a lot going on, and you read some of these memos, and these objects were very obviously being taken seriously by senior military personnel. I mean, hey, if I were in charge of the airspace of something as sensitive as the Oak Ridge Nuclear Facility or Los Alamos or Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, and something
was invading the airspace of my facility, you know, I'd want to know what it was too, and so did these guys. And so that got me really interested. And of course, the logical first question that a lot of them would ask was, is this Soviet? Did the Russians come up with some kind of radical, new, revolutionary technology? Turns out, we did look into this, and it turns out there's no evidence to show that they did. Next logical question is this some kind of deep, black, secret program that the Americans had? Another reasonable question to ask, without a doubt. And this is a little more of a tricky issue, because some people think that there's a lot of reason to think that we did kind of invent flying saucers in the 1940s. I do not. I've looked and looked. I see little bits of hints here and there that we were indeed looking at some unusual airframes, disc-shaped designs, and so on. I just see no evidence that we had anything operational going, you know, in the late 1940s. And even if we did, that's interesting too. So there's a lot of interesting things about this early UFO phenomenon that really caught my attention. And so the next thing I knew, what started out as a personal pet project morphed into this comprehensive, or at least pretty big fat study that I did. Partly because I was looking for my book. I wanted to get a nice sort of straightforward, no grandstanding, nice 500-page history that would lay out what happened and then what happened and then what happened without too much editorializing.
Yeah. It's really a fantastic book. I can't praise it enough. It's like a history of ufology, really.
Yeah, thanks. It's funny because when I started writing this book, I knew very little about UFO research, the history of it. I barely knew what Roswell was. I hardly knew what Area 51 was. I mean, honestly, the most bare bones ufology 101 kind of knowledge is what I had. And it's interesting when I look back on it because I had a very good education compared with most people. I had a very excellent background in American history. And yet, I mean, how odd it is that you could go through a very extensive kind of in-depth program of study, which I did, and not really deal with any of this.
Yeah.
It was a big, big blank. And so I had to get myself up to speed. Fortunately, I had a good historical background to start with, and I had a pretty good knowledge as a trained historian how to hunt through and get my information and then kind of put it together. And writing that book was my education in ufology. And the funny thing is that that story goes from 1941 to 1973, and I cut it off at 1973. A couple of reasons. One is that I felt that it did kind of form a nice point to break off the story, which, if you want, we can get into. But yeah. The other reason is I didn't have the knowledge or energy or physical strength to go beyond 1973 at that point when I finished that book.
Yeah.
It's taken me 5 years to really make sure I'm up to speed on the last 30, 35 years of ufology, and I'm at that point now, but it took a while. It was a huge education for me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I think this first edition of the book, it has a nice story arc to it, so it worked out really well the way it ended up.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you feel that way.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time trying to make that a smooth read, by the way.
Oh yeah, it was. It was definitely. It was. Once you get going into it, you're flying through it. Mine's worn, so I carry it everywhere.
I'm glad.
I was reading. Now, as an author, I guess, or like what, as a sort of editorial choice, you included a lot of sightings reports in the book.
I did.
What were you going for there with including so many sightings reports instead of just a straightforward historical narrative?
Well, I tried to do both, to be honest with you. I did. I had a lot of sightings in there. I tried, if you notice, to focus on military sightings and military-related. If it wasn't a military sighting per se, then I wanted it to be something that at least the military seems to have investigated. So my focus throughout was to show that this was a topic that has significant national security implications.
Yeah.
The other thing about the book that I really felt it was important that I provide in a nice book form I mean, on the one hand, something that's a narrative, but on the other hand, something that is somewhat of a reference book or somewhat encyclopedic. Not an encyclopedia per se, because it doesn't read like that. But, for example, I wanted someone, if they had this idea, hey, what was that event in May 1957? And then you could use my book to look it up.
Yeah.
So that was my other basic goal. And so the book stylistically really is a combination of those two different types of efforts. And it's at times maybe an uneasy marriage, but that was what I decided to do.
Oh, yeah, well, it works well. I just wanted to ask you about that, because I noticed it. I was like, there's a lot of sightings here.
And the other thing, too, is that I guess I did want a little bit of the sledgehammer effect. I don't want to just beat someone to death with fact after fact after fact, but I did feel it was important to emphasize to, let's say, an intelligent but skeptical reader that there is a mass of evidence. I mean, it's not even a mass. It's an overwhelming, huge amount of, I mean, one sighting after the next, after the next, after the next, and of really better quality than a lot of people would realize. So I wanted to emphasize that as well.
Exactly, exactly. It's a wealth of proof as we can provide it pretty much as far as sightings go, and that helps a lot. Because otherwise, if you were reading it and you didn't believe in UFOs, you'd be like, show me your evidence, you know?
Well, exactly. And so I really wanted to convey a lot of, kind of a bit of both. I mean, on the one hand, the evidence, on the other hand, a story. And there is a story in this first book. It's the story of, a couple of things. One, this problem of UFOs as it dropped into the lap of the American military at the end of World War II. And then the story of some civilians in the 1950s and then 60s to try to break the secrecy on it, and ultimately the story of how that attempt failed.
Yeah, that was pretty much the story arc I was talking about too, yeah. Because it's like, sort of getting into the book now, seems like 47 was the year when it really sort of exploded and kicked off with Kenneth Arnold and Roswell and perhaps the beginnings of the MJ-12.
Sure.
The beginning of ufology pretty much in America.
Well, it was the beginning, you know, what is ufology, one might ask.
Yeah,
but yes, certainly the beginning of flying saucer consciousness.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone was talking about UFOs that early. That was a phrase that came just a tiny bit later. But yeah, I mean, the whole UFO controversy exploded onto America in that year. And in the early years, it was very common for people to talk about the whole thing starting out in 1947. And actually, the more we would research, the more we found that, no, actually, there were some really interesting UFO sightings in 1946. And then people discover, hey, there's a lot of this going on in World War II. And then people say, hey, well, actually, back in the 1890s, there was a really interesting wave of odd sightings, and there was a wave around World War I in New England. And then the next thing you know, this is something that's really going potentially very far back, but of course my book didn't deal with the early stuff.
Yeah, but it's like that's when it sort of got impacted onto the consciousness of America.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it fell into the lap of Truman and all, and then his administration and everything. And then when Eisenhower was elected, there seemed to be like a concerted effort to take the UFO issue and take the power over the UFO arena out of the executive office with the creation of the NSA and the Robertson panel. Is that like a tricky observation?
That's kind of the way I guess I would say. What you had is, you know, first you got the Truman years, and from the time that the UFO controversy hit America really in 1947 until the end of 1952. You got one president, it's Harry Truman, and he's the guy on the job. And what really happened was a series of crises that culminated in 1952, Truman's last year in the White House. And there was sightings over the White House a couple of weekends, and there were massive sightings throughout the United States. A lot of them were military, and it was something that really got the intelligence community very concerned about. Like, how do we deal with this? How do we deal with it publicly? And indeed, what does all of this mean? But in the public relations part of it, the intelligence community, basically the CIA and Air Force intelligence, made a definite decision to take this problem and remove it, as it were, one step further out of the hands of you know, even the standard military channels. And so you get what was called the Robertson Panel. This is the last weekend of the Truman presidency in January 1953. You had a bunch of Nobel-caliber scientists who reviewed this for a couple of hours. The conclusions were already preordained. We know this now.
Yeah.
And what they decided to do is to... Well, they said, you know, there's really nothing as far as national security that we have to worry about here. But we also need to sort of keep this issue very low-key with the public, and they recommended certain measures to do that. And so what happened during the Eisenhower administration was Project Blue Book, which had been the kind of public relations effort of the Air Force, that was... you know, the public investigative body that the Air Force had, that was basically stripped of all personnel and was bare bones for the next decade until it went under.
Yeah.
And a lot of UFO reports never went to Blue Book, and the whole thing did become much more compartmentalized and out of the public realm. So that's so that a lot of the UFO reports that we know about, we learned about a few during the golden era of the Freedom of Information Act in the late 70s, and people were shocked when they said, wow, well, this report, this wasn't a Blue Book report, and neither was this one, and neither was this one. So there was this whole other channel of UFO reports that, you know, no one had really known to discuss because there was just no knowledge of it. So, yeah, the thing became a bit more, yeah, I think it became more secretive by degrees from the 40s and then into the 50s. What happened in the 1960s was a kind of crisis, a second crisis, you might say, because there was the original one in 1952. But then there was another crisis in the mid-60s, and frankly, it was because there were many, many significant UFO sightings in this country again, starting in 64 then, big time in 1965 and then 66, so much so that the issue made it to Congress. And this was quite significant. It really hadn't made it to Congress in any major way before that. On the other hand, the Air Force's explanations through Project Blue Book were becoming seen by a lot of people as just, you know, completely ludicrous. I mean, everything was Venus, everything was swamp gas, everything was balloons, and ordinary intelligent people started saying, hey, this is a joke. And the Air Force is really starting to lose credibility. This is the time of the Vietnam War, and I think the last thing the Air Force wanted was one more public relations headache. And so what they wanted to do was just unload Blue Book ASAP. And also, I think what the Air Force did not want was actual true congressional hearings on this matter. I mean, if you want to keep secret a lot of the more sensationalistic accounts and sightings that have happened, and there were many that happened in the 1960s, and really the last thing you want is for a kind of open hearing on this where who knows what can leak out.
Yeah, yeah.
So what they did was they ponied up a couple of $100,000, $500,000, paid the University of Colorado to do a what was supposed to be a scientific study of all of this, which Colorado did. The problem was that the guy running it was Edward Condon, who was a known, very, very openly skeptical person who really knew nothing about this topic and made no bones about that. And his number two guy was a fellow named Robert Lowe, who I believe had been in CIA in the 1940s, I'm pretty sure. What we do know about Lowe is that he was, like Condon, hell-bent on a negative conclusion right from the outset of this. And that there was a mutiny among the researchers midway into the project because they had become convinced that there seemed to be something to this and that they knew the leadership of the project was just going to be dead set for no conclusion no matter what. Things came to a climax in early 68 and the leading members of the project got fired, replaced with a new half of a crew, and that is what wrote the Colorado Report, which... Even that report, even though it was, Condon wrote, well, the evidence shows that there's nothing to this topic. In fact, 30% of the cases in the Colorado report showed, concluded unknown. And in fact, a couple of those cases were just within a scintilla of the writer acknowledging that this was very possibly alien. So there were a couple of cases, even in the Colorado report, that were really, you know, no one wants to come out and just say, yeah, I think it's alien.
Yeah.
But in fact, a number of those cases were really, really very persuasive. Anyway, what happened at the end of that, in 1969, the Condon Report is issued, and the Air Force says, okay, thank you very much. They washed their hands of it. We're not doing any UFOs anymore. Thank you very much. And we're gone. No more. Well, in a way that happened, but in another way it didn't, because certainly UFO reports continued through the 1970s and 80s, and they continue today. It's just that there is no official government body that, you know, claims to be investigating them. But we do know that these reports happen, that these encounters happen, that the military still, of course, they're going to be interested. Something comes into your airspace and it's not identified. Clearly, you're going to investigate what it's all about. The problem is finding information about this is, ever since the 1980s, it's been a real iffy prospect. And actually since really the last 5-6 years, it's been so difficult to get any kind of UFO-related information out of the government. One really has to wonder how long this dark period is going to last, at least in terms of not being able to get anything out of our government.
Yeah. And sort of like jumping back a little bit, in 1951, Ruppelt, he's at a meeting, and there's a guy there, and sort of shadowy reference, sort of like a secret controller group.
Oh, I know what you're referring to, yeah. Well, first, for some of the listeners who may not know, I mean, I'm sure many do recognize the name Edward Ruppelt. Edward Ruppelt was the Air Force captain who at that time had just become in charge of what would soon be called Project Blue Book. And I think you're referring to an October 1951 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is very interesting because I'm glad you mentioned this. There had been a very spectacular radar tracking of a very fast and unusual object out of Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. As a result of this, Edward Ruppelt wrote in his book, which he wrote about 5 years later, that there was a very kind of high-level meeting with some people in the aerospace community and some high-level government officials, I think he said, whom I can't name, from an agency that I can't name. Now, maybe that's CIA. He doesn't really say.
Yeah.
And that these individuals who weren't, not all of them seemed to be actual government people, but Ruppelt did say that they had total access to the files at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that were pertaining to UFOs. So these guys, whoever they were in kind of an unofficial, high-level group with a strong interest in controlling the information on the UFO phenomenon. He never said who they were.
Yes.
When I read that, I mean, certainly it doesn't take a lot to realize that he's describing something that sounds very much like an MJ-12 type of group. And again, MJ-12 has become sort of a catch-all name for just the UFO control group, the nebulous guys like the cigarette smoking man, the X-Files, the group of individuals who are imagined or believed to be the controlling group behind all of this. And by the way, I think there's very good reason to think that there is such a group. Absolutely.
One of the things that I was surprised by when I read the book is this I never really realized, even though I fancied myself pretty knowledgeable about the UFO subject, was the Blue Book really ran for quite a long time.
Yes, it did. It ran, I mean, if you really want to count its earlier incarnations under Project Grudge, it went pretty much full guns from, 1951, and then had its heyday for exactly 1 year, right up until the very beginning of 1953, and then kept going in truncated form right up until 1968, 69. It was closed down at the end of 69. Although really for the last couple of years, Blue Book was just a total skeleton crew, especially while the University of Colorado was doing its study. The Blue Book almost totally abdicated any kind of investigative role. But, it went for about 17, 18 years.
Yeah, and it really degenerated over that time.
Most definitely.
It seemed like there was a lot of pressure from up top to bring the unknowns down. Was there a significant, like, at first it started out really high for
absolutely.
And by the end it was like 2-1% or something.
Yeah, you've got an excellent memory of all of this. What happened was in the earliest years, unknowns were typically at 15-20%. It's pretty high. And then after the Robertson panel, within a year of that, the guys at Blue Book started getting these memos, really, from the bosses up in the Air Force to bring the unknowns down to 5%. And then throughout the late 50s, I mean, they were getting it down to like 1 and 2%. In order to this mean their investigative techniques had improved? Well, no, absolutely not. If anything, they got worse. But what they did do was, of course, force-fit all kinds of possible explanations. Anything that could remotely be considered, you know, if you didn't investigate, hey, a lot of things are possible, and since they didn't do any investigations, everything became Venus or weather balloon or possible balloon or... And if it was a possible, then in the subsequent editions of the reports, the possible would be eliminated, and it would just be, you know, balloon or whatever, but something totally conventional. It was ludicrous. And one thing I noticed from just looking at the Blue Book on the ones that passed through that gauntlet and still became unknown is that a lot of those are just the most innocuous, boring unknowns of all. So they, like, you know, for example, a light that you'd see in the distance move to the left and then move to the right and then wink out after about a minute. That would be an unknown. I mean, who's going to get excited over that?
Yeah.
So, there were really very few or almost no spectacular unknowns, especially in the last couple of years of Blue Book. They just didn't let, if it was a really good report, it would either not be in Blue Book, which was usually the case, or they'd find a way to explain it away. It really is extraordinary. There's one case that I think is particularly extraordinary from 1962, and this is believed to be a crash of a UFO right outside Las Vegas in April of 1962. In Blue Book, this was described very deceptively as two separate sightings. What had happened is an object was streaking across the United States at about 4,000 miles an hour from New York State, not too far from where I am right now, across the United States out to Nevada. It was an object that caused the scrambling of jets out of Luke Air Force Base in Phoenix and also Nellis Air Force Base in Vegas. It was not a meteorite or a bolide or any kind of atmospheric thing. It was moving way too slowly for that, but way too fast for any conventional aircraft. 4,000 miles an hour is kind of in a very uncomfortable in-between speed there. Blue Book explained that as two separate sightings by using different time zones. So the sighting out, the object exploded outside of Las Vegas, and that was said to be one thing, and then the object that streaked across the U.S. and was seen over Utah hovering for a little bit, that was supposed to be another thing. Described at two different times, but actually it was the same time. They just used different time zones.
Yeah.
And, I mean, really, you can't do that by accident. That was clearly an act of intentional deception just to get out of having to explain a really difficult case.
Yeah. And the people who were at sort of within the government at that time, let's say 1952, excuse me, is sort of a reference to like a UFO party of people who wanted the truth to come out, and they were
right. And
they were sort of at war with the people who wanted to keep it in house.
Yeah, that's right. And you find this happens throughout the history of the UFO phenomenon. It was happening back then, and it happens now. It's going on right now. There always seem to be factions that develop, whatever time period we're dealing with, that look at this evidence, that have access to really some good cases, and decide, hey, you know what, this is important, and frankly, people need to know about this, and they don't deserve to be lied to about it. And such a faction developed in 1952, and really it developed for a couple of reasons. One, I think the individuals involved, such as Major Dewey Furnett, he was one of the better known ones, it was a retired Marine Corps Major Donald Kehoe, and there were a number of other people. And they said, hey, you know, we have enough faith in the American people to handle the truth about this. We don't need to be treated like children. And B, it's this is something of a disingenuous argument, but they said, hey, look, if you keep telling the military personnel that there's nothing to flying saucers, which indeed was the public line, then what's going to happen if one of these is mistaken for some Soviet missile and you start a war because you haven't really informed your own military sufficiently?
Yeah.
The reason I think this is a disingenuous argument is because, frankly, these guys had to know that within the deep classified world, there were channels that existed that knew all about UFOs, and they weren't going to mistake UFOs for something conventional, usually. But these guys are able to make the argument publicly. So anyway, they tried to do this. I mean, during the great UFO year of 1952, in the ramp-up to the Robertson panel, in those months in the fall of 1952, by the way, that's when the National Security Agency was formed, right? Toward the very end of the Truman years, formed in total secrecy. No one knew about this for years. There was a real possibility, some thought, that the UFO secret could come out. And so you had really these two factions working very hard. The upper hand was always in the hand of the guys with who wanted to keep the secret.
Yeah, but it was like the first in-house battle over getting it out.
Yeah, the first big one. The first big one.
Yeah.
There was a little one a couple of years before that, in 1948, when the first Project Sign, kind of the earliest predecessor of Blue Book, they issued a report that got to the desk of General Hoyt Vandenberg, General of the Air Force, that apparently said that this is extraterrestrial, or seems to be extraterrestrial, and Vandenberg had the report destroyed. Despite the fact that there isn't any single copy of this so-called estimate of the situation, no one really doubts its existence. There are just too many sources verifying it. But yeah, I think 1952 was the first really big confrontation, and the cause of secrecy won that. And then, as I was saying a little earlier, the issue publicly kind of went to sleep for almost a decade. I mean, there were sightings here and there. You had people who were claiming to be contactees and things like that, but there was really no serious traction until really the mid-1960s in the United States, and then the issue just, bam, became very prominent again. And you had another sort of confrontation. This one, we don't know so much about within the military as we do between the civilian groups and the military, but again, the side of secrecy won that one.
Yeah, it's like a continuing, it seems like every time it builds to a head, the secrecy side wins, and then it sort of dies out for a while.
Right, and as I'll be mentioning in my next volume, this story continues in a very, very interesting way through the 1970s, into the 1980s, into the 1990s for sure. It happened one of those remaining decades of the 20th century.
Yeah.
In the 1970s. And all of these are caused usually by some sort of crisis that occurs. In the 70s, it was the political crisis of Watergate. And what happened as a result of that? Well, you had a period in this nation's history in the mid-70s when Congress really tried to reassert its traditional role as against what had been seen as the kind of accumulation of power by the executive. And one of the things that they pushed through, I mean, Nixon signed the order, but it was really under pressure, which was an expansion of the Freedom of Information Act. And then when Jimmy Carter became president a couple of years after that, Carter himself issued an executive order that dramatically strengthened that. So by the late 70s, I think of this all as a result of Watergate and the disillusionment with Vietnam. The United States was probably its most liberal state of mind that it had been in maybe ever. And the FOIA resulted in a real bonanza of documents for UFO researchers. The hope at that time was, great. This is our tool. The FOIA is our tool to get the real proof out of the government that this is a real phenomenon and that they take it seriously. And in fact, it turned out to be a great period, but it didn't give you the magic bullet that had been wanted. A couple of reasons. And one, that even when Carter strengthened the FOIA, it really wasn't strong enough, to be perfectly honest. I mean, there was always the out for federal agencies, which was any information that would be seen as damaging national security was exempt. And so that's a huge loophole right there.
Yeah.
We know from the few documents that we've gotten out that the UFO topic was considered top secret. We have one FBI document from the 1940s that states this explicitly. And yet, of all the documents that we received through the FOIA, basically none of them were of the top secret level. All were of lower levels of classification, like secret or restricted or confidential. Yeah. What that means is, you know, let's say that UFOs per se are not top secret, but let's say that the alien nature of UFOs, that's top secret or higher, right?
Yeah.
Therefore, any document that's only secret or only confidential, by definition, must not have reference to the ET or alien nature of UFOs. And so those are safer documents.
Yeah.
And some of those are still pretty amazing. But they don't, they're not a single, there's no memo from the president that says, you know, what are we going to do about these pesky aliens?
Yeah.
So none of those came out in FOIA.
So it's kind of like the unknowns in Blue Book, pretty much.
Yeah, but better. I mean, a better quality of cases. I mean, much more suggestive. You start reading a number of even these reports, these confidential reports. I mean, they were still classified. They just weren't the highest classifications. And you read 50 or 100 of these, and you start to think, hey, you know, there's clearly something very, very bizarre going on. What happened was that the FOIA was severely curtailed during the Reagan years. In April of 1982, President Reagan issued an executive order that took a lot of wind out of the sails of the Freedom of Information Act. Didn't overturn it, but made it much, much less user-friendly, a lot more expensive, exempted NORAD totally from the Freedom of Information Act, and that's important. And so then you go through the Reagan-Bush years with there were various attempts from the inside to leak information out, it appears, but not much of a public opportunity to yank these secrets out. You get to the Clinton years, and it's a bit different. Clinton, like Reagan actually, had a very, very open interest in UFOs. But unlike Reagan, was a little bit more interested in some government openness on this matter, and so issued an executive order in the mid-90s that was a real windfall for a lot of researchers, including the people in UFO, and really liberalized some of the Freedom of Information Act provisions. So that combined with a number of inside efforts that included Lawrence Rockefeller to meet with Clinton people to try to open up the process for disclosure, as it was becoming called at that time. That's an interesting story, too, and it's something that I'll be writing about at length in the next book. But suffice to say that this crescendo also ended in ultimate disappointment. This was a period in which the Air Force again took really, really smart initiative and issued its infamous Roswell report.
Yeah.
And this came out in 1994. So again, when you get this whole resurgence of the Roswell case and then this resurgence of possibility that the Clintons might release UFO information, and there is good reason to think that they were trying to do this, the Air Force, boom, goes into high gear to basically beat the General Accounting Office to the punch, because the GAO was also charged with looking into Roswell, and they were much more critical.
Yes.
The Air Force goes, bam, high gear, gets it done, releases a report before the GAO is even out of the gate, and says, no, it was basically, sorry, we thought it was a weather balloon. In fact, it wasn't, but it was a balloon. It was just a top-secret balloon known as Mogul. I'm sure many people have heard of it. And then a year later, they said, as for the claims of bodies, actually, no, but we were doing dummy drops in the 1950s, and I think people just got confused with the time frames and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was really clever because they very, very astutely were efficient in getting that report done and dominating the public relations battleground.
Yeah.
And they got the media on their side, which they always do anyway. So the whole, the Clinton attempt of disclosure, I mean, that just went down in flames too. By the end of the Clinton years, even before Bush came into the White House, apparently there was already a covert movement to reclassify many of the thousands of documents that had been declassified as per Clinton's executive order. And this information has only recently come out.
Oh, wow.
I myself was at the U.S. National Archives in College Park, Maryland, just a couple of months ago when this news came out. And here's the deal. This is really quite fascinating. We just discovered, and the chief archivist of the United States discovered, that someone has been reclassifying thousands and thousands of previously declassified documents. So that, in other words, if you were a UFO researcher or any kind of researcher, and in 1998 you got a document that had been declassified.
Yeah.
And if that document was then reclassified, you would not be allowed to photocopy or present that document to anybody.
Oh, man.
That's right. And that, in fact, is the case. Now, that reclassification has gone full blast since 9/11.
Yeah.
But the point is that the chief archivist of the United States did not issue this order, does not know who or what agency issued the order, at least as of a month ago. This was not known. I don't think it's known now. So someone's been reclassifying these things, and we've gone into reverse gear at high speed.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, we've gotten to a point where in this country, the situation is almost diametrically opposite what the founders intended in the sense of government openness. That is, it's supposed to be that people are supposed to be able to look into their government and have privacy in their homes from government snooping. And in fact, it's exactly the reverse. And government can read your email, but you're not allowed to see what's going on in government. And that's very unsettling. And not to get overly political on this, I mean, we're talking about UFOs, but hey, I argue that it does matter. If you believe, as I do, in the value of UFO disclosure, then it does matter what kind of government you're dealing with.
Yeah.
Are you dealing with a democratic government? Or are you dealing with a government that isn't truly democratic and that is, in fact, authoritarian in some form?
Yeah.
And so I feel that we need to know exactly what we are dealing with. I think UFO researchers are, by and large, coming around and have largely come around to the idea that their government is not a truly democratic one. A lot of the old guard, let's call them the old guard UFO researchers, really were not ever of this opinion, and some of them still are not. But the times, they are changing, and
yeah,
I think it's impossible. It is impossible not to see what's going on all around us. You know, unless you want to stop up your ears and cover your eyes.
And then a lot of the audience, my audience here, they're big fans of esoteric radio, pretty much what you got to listen to find out any UFO information, and sort of like we're like a little brother of esoteric radio. And one of the key figures who emerged in the book that I want to talk about a little bit, because I had never really heard much about him, but he was sort of like the first Art Bell, Frank Edwards.
Oh, yeah.
He's sort of a cautionary tale in a way, because it sounded like he was on top of the world as far as the media world goes, and then as he got into the UFO subject, things really went downhill faster. So talk about him a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Frank Edwards, he was like an early Art Bell, extremely popular radio host back in the 1950s, and he, as you say, he had a very a regular kind of fringy sort of show that he had on a regular basis. He had a nationwide audience, millions of listeners. So yeah, a lot like Art Bell or George Norrie. And Frank Edwards frequently was one of the first guys to break all kinds of UFO stories. Stuff would get leaked to him, it would get on his show, and the information would get out. Frank Edwards was also a very good friend of Major Donald Kehoe, who really was the premier UFO voice a voice, I guess, for UFO openness in the 1950s and 60s. And Kehoe was, he'd been a friend of Charles Lindbergh back in the day, and knew a lot of high-level Navy and CIA brass as well.
Yeah.
So he was friends with Edwards. So Edwards, there's one story, you might remember this better than I do. I haven't looked at it much in the last few years, but I did write about it. Edwards, in the mid-50s, lost his show.
Yeah.
And he lost it as, as a result of, it came to a head with the Navy, I believe, over something that they wanted him to keep quiet about.
I can't recall the specific case. Either.
I'm sorry that I'm a little fuzzy on that.
Oh, don't worry about it.
But you're right. Then he ended up, he lost his show. He got kind of, his ratings had been great. And boom, he was out of a radio show. He still was a public name. I mean, everyone sort of knew who Frank Edwards was. And he ended up writing a hugely successful book in 1966 called Flying Saucers, Serious Business. That's it.
Yeah.
This book sold something like 500,000 copies.
Oh, wow.
You think about that. My book sold maybe 20,000 copies. Edwards sold 500,000 copies of this book. Kind of a sensationalist book. I mean, not what you'd call a scholarly work, but really not a bad book in a lot of ways. There's a lot of decent information in there. And he wrote a follow-up book in 67, felt like he was on top of the world, and then died, dropped dead of a heart attack. In Kehoe's opinion, I don't think Kehoe was willing to go out on record and say it would seem suspicious, but Kehoe did seem that, I think he implied that things did not seem all right with Edwards' death.
Yeah.